You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're plunging into, well, a truly harrowing, sometimes unbelievable chapter of medical history, the long, painful journey to conquering surgical pain. Just try to imagine the medical world back then, late 18th, early 19th centuries. We're talking surgeons working by candlelight, relying on sheer speed, brute force sometimes, and patients. They were enduring just unimaginable agony. Because back then, pain wasn't just, you know, an unfortunate side effect. It was often seen as an assumed, even maybe therapeutic, part of the healing process. But what's truly astonishing, though, is that the very solutions to this immense suffering, they were discovered, observed, even tested sometimes. Yet so often they were just dismissed or simply overlooked for decades. It's kind of baffling.
It really is. It's a journey that genuinely forces you to reconsider our assumptions about medical progress, how it actually happens. So our mission today is to trace this fascinating and sometimes, yeah, tragic path. We'll highlight the profound human cost of these early medical practices, alongside the incremental, often frustratingly delayed steps that led us to the pain-free surgery we now just take for granted. You'll hear about these moments of profound insight that really should have changed everything. And then we'll try to explore why. Why was progress so stubbornly slow?
Okay, let's do it. Let's turn back the clock. Our story kicks off with a truly surprising character and a guest that would become famous for laughing. It's in 1798, Bristol, England. Thomas Beddoes establishes something called the Pneumatic Institution. Now, this wasn't your typical hospital. It was this innovative clinic focused on exploring the medical uses for different gases. They thought air itself held healing properties, especially for pulmonary tuberculosis. And to oversee his laboratory, Beddoes brings in this brilliant, ambitious, and remarkably young chemist, only 20 years old, named Humphrey Davy.
It's 20. Incredible.
Right. And what does young Davy do? He dives headfirst into extensive self-experimentation with nitrous oxide. He's inhaling what would later be called laughing gas in pretty large amounts. And this is where a really pivotal moment occurs. Davy makes this extraordinary observation. The gas has this astonishing ability to diminish or even completely abolish physical pain.
He actually felt it himself.
Exactly. He doesn't just feel it. He documents it meticulously. Then in 1800, Davy publishes this huge 580-page book detailing his nitrous oxide experiments. And buried within it, he includes this incredibly prophetic suggestion. He writes, "As nitrous oxide in its extensive operation appears capable of destroying physical pain, it may probably be used with advantage during surgical operations in which no great effusion of blood takes place."
Wow, that's incredibly specific.
It's crystal clear. A groundbreaking statement laid out for anyone to see.
Yeah, what's truly striking here, especially when you consider the historical context, is the sheer foresight of Davy's observation. And yet, the profound indifference that met it from the medical community is just stark. You really have to wonder, why did such a monumental insight go pretty much unnoticed for nearly half a century? It wasn't like a quiet little note. He wrote an entire book about it.
Right.
Maybe it just challenged those really deeply held beliefs about pain being natural, even necessary. Or perhaps the idea of inhaling a gas, you know, for serious pain relief just seemed too frivolous, especially coming from a young chemist, not a surgeon.
Yeah, maybe not serious enough for the established medical figures.
They just weren't ready, perhaps, to believe in a world without that surgical agony.
Absolutely. It's mind-boggling. And this overlooked genius, it really stands in stark contrast to the prevailing medical practices of the time. Like, in 1800, the U.S. had only 4 medical schools. And prominent physicians like Benjamin Rush over the University of Pennsylvania, he was trying to reduce labor pain, not with gases, but through really aggressive bloodletting.
Bloodletting to reduce pain.
Yeah. Think about the sheer brutality of that.
Yeah.
Draining a patient's blood to try and alleviate pain. It's hard to wrap your head around. However, around this time, we do see a different kind of progress, albeit on a chemical front. In 1803, Friedrich Sertürner, a German pharmacist, he successfully isolates morphine from opium.
Ah, okay. That's a big deal.
Huge deal. The first purified alkaloid, a powerful chemical compound derived from a plant specifically for potent pain relief. So you've got this true chemical pain reliever discovered, but brutal, often counterproductive practices like extreme bloodletting, they just continued right alongside it.
That's the paradox, isn't it?
It's a shocking paradox. Consider this really disturbing detail from 1809. A Captain James Niblett was reportedly bled of 600 ounces of blood over 2 months.
600 ounces.
600. It's an extreme example, sure, but it highlights just how desperate and, frankly, misguided pain management could be without truly effective, reliable options, even with something like morphine technically available.
It's almost like medicine was caught between these two worlds, wasn't it? You have the very sort of nascent understanding of chemistry starting to reveal powerful agents like morphine, and then these deeply entrenched, often harmful traditions like bloodletting. The fact that extreme bloodletting was so widely accepted, it just underscores how profoundly practitioners were struggling. They were reaching for anything to alleviate suffering, even if it often caused more harm than good. Precisely because they lacked that cohesive scientific understanding of pain and, you know, truly effective, predictable alternatives.
Yeah, the desperation must have been immense.
The willingness to inflict such drastic measures really speaks volumes.
And the human cost of surgery without anesthesia during this era, it's truly difficult to fully grasp. For a really poignant example, think about the novelist Fanny Burney. In 1811, she underwent a mastectomy without any anesthesia whatsoever.
Wow, that's horrifying to even imagine.
Her later accounts describe not just the unbearable physical pain, but also this lingering emotional trauma. What we'd now easily recognize as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Her descriptions are just so vivid, powerful reminders of the profound psychological toll these procedures took. It lasted long after the physical wounds had healed.
That's such an important point. Her account isn't just a historical anecdote. It's this incredibly powerful early description of post-traumatic stress. It really reminds us of the impact these experiences had beyond just the immediate physical pain.
Definitely. And then just a few years later, 1818, another significant observation is made. And again, it's missed as a clinical opportunity. Michael Faraday, another brilliant chemist, he observed that ether diethyl ether produced effects similar to nitrous oxide. It caused a kind of stupefaction.
Okay, so another potential candidate.
Exactly. But he warned about prolonged lethargy, and like Davy's work on nitrous oxide, his observation just wasn't pursued clinically for pain relief.
It's astounding, really, how many pieces of the puzzle were right there, but nobody was putting them together for surgery.
Right. Meanwhile, the prevailing belief that pain was just an inevitable part of healing, it just continued. Look at Sir Walter Scott in 1819, suffering intensely from bloodletting and blistering for stomach cramps. For most people, suffering was just the way things were.
Yeah, Fanny Burney's account really challenges that notion that pain was merely physiological. It highlights those deep psychological scars. And Faraday's observation on ether, even with his caution, it just further illustrates the pattern, doesn't it? The scientific tools, the observations, they were often present. But that conceptual leap, seeing them as solutions for surgical pain, that leap just wasn't being made by the wider medical establishment.
Okay, so as we move into the 1820s, we start seeing sort of two parallel developments happening. There's the relentless reality of surgery's physical toll still very much present, and then these emerging avenues for actually sharing medical knowledge.
Yeah.
In 1822, you hear about the surgeon Robert Liston. He was renowned for his incredible speed, performing complex tumor excisions under, well, appalling conditions is how it's described.
Speed was everything then.
Absolutely. His ability to operate quickly was crucial, not necessarily for surgical precision in the modern sense, but simply to minimize the patient's time and agony. It just underscores how desperate the situation still was. But then a really crucial shift in medical communication starts. The Lancet published its first issue in 1823.
The Lancet, still going strong.
Right. Fundamentally changed how medical discoveries and practices were disseminated. And this was soon followed by the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal in 1828. So the reach of medical discussion was expanding.
Okay, so knowledge sharing is improving.
Yes, but here's an intriguing development that shows it wasn't just about sharing. In 1823 and 24, a physician named Henry Hickman conducted experiments. He used carbon dioxide to induce a state of suspended animation, basically, a reversible unconsciousness in animals. And he performed painless surgery on them.
With carbon dioxide. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And he reported his groundbreaking work to the Royal Society. He even wrote to King Charles X of France. But his findings were completely ignored.
Just ignored. Despite showing painless surgery in animals.
It's dismissed out of hand.
Yeah.
It's frustrating to read about. On a slightly brighter note, maybe for future developments, Benjamin Babington in 1829 developed indirect laryngoscopy, a crucial step for airway management later on. allowing doctors to actually see and manage a patient's breathing passage.
Right, that's important groundwork. But it's fascinating, isn't it, how these increasing avenues for sharing discoveries, like the Lancet and the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal, could exist. Yet truly innovative ideas like Hickman's could still be just summarily dismissed. It really speaks to a deeply ingrained resistance, I think, to radically new approaches to pain. It suggests that while the channels for information got better, the collective mindset of the medical community wasn't necessarily ready to embrace concepts that defied centuries of tradition and belief about suffering.
Yeah, the established views were maybe just too strong.
These new journals, while valuable, probably also amplified the dominant views of the time, including the skepticism.
Okay, so heading into the 1830s, we see the discovery of another future anesthetic, chloroform. But the prevailing attitude, pain is still very much inevitable. Surgeons like James Syme in 1830 recorded an astonishing 95 complex operations in just 1 year. Amputations, tumor excisions, hernia repairs.
95. Without anesthesia.
All without anesthesia. Just imagine the sheer endurance required from both the patient and the surgeon. Often just a frantic race against the clock and against shock.
Unbelievable.
Then in 1831, chloroform was independently discovered by three different people. Joseph von Liebig, Eugene Subarin, and Samuel Guthrie. This substance would later become incredibly important in anesthesia, obviously, but at the time, its significance for surgery just wasn't recognized at all.
Another one just sitting there, essentially.
Pretty much. And the dire reality of surgery without anesthesia continued. You look at William Bland's work in Australia between 1832 and 1837. Prolonged, often fatal surgeries to tie off bursting blood vessels in the neck and shoulder. Grueling high-stakes procedures. And this then brings us to this really stunning declaration by the prominent French surgeon Alfred Velpeau in 1839. He stated flatly that pain in surgery was inevitable, and he dismissed anesthesia as a chimera, like a fantasy, an impossible dream.
A chimera. Wow, that's a powerful statement of disbelief.
And this mindset, incredibly, was the norm. By 1840, the U.S. had about 30 medical schools, but the curricula were limited, no female students were admitted, and surgical practices were spreading globally without anesthesia. That was just the standard.
Velpeau's blunt assertion that pain was inevitable, even after substances like nitrous oxide, ether, and chloroform had been discovered and described, it truly underscores the profound conceptual barrier of that era. It wasn't just ignorance, like you said, it was almost a philosophical stance. The very idea of pain-free surgery was considered fantasy. It reflected this deep-seated acceptance of suffering as just an unavoidable part of the process, maybe even necessary for healing in some twisted way.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine thinking that way now.
It really makes you wonder if some part of the medical mind back then couldn't even conceive of a world without surgical pain. It was just reality.
Okay, so now we enter the 1840s. This decade finally brought true, tangible glimpses of anesthesia. But while it was still riddled with missed opportunities, these sort of ether's lost moments. In 1842, a dentist named William Clark used ether for a tooth extraction, successfully anesthetized his patient, a Miss Hobby.
A dentist, okay.
He achieved it, but then completely failed to publicize its revolutionary potential. It was this groundbreaking act that just went unnoticed by the wider world, faded away.
So close.
So close. And that same year, down in Georgia, Dr. Crawford Long successfully used ether to anesthetize a patient named James Venable for a tumor removal from his neck. Long actually went on to perform multiple ether-based surgeries, all successfully, over the next few years.
Okay, so he used it repeatedly. That's significant.
Very significant. But crucially, he delayed publishing his results until 1849.
1849, but the big public demonstration was in 46.
Exactly. He missed critical recognition for what was a truly monumental discovery and application because he didn't publish promptly.
Oh, that's rough. History could have been different.
Could have been. And then, a few years later, 1846, another near miss, Elton Romeo Smiley inadvertently achieved anesthesia with an ether-opium mixture on a tubercular patient. The patient was definitely anesthetized. But Smiley misattributed the effect entirely to the opium.
Attributed it to the wrong drug.
Yep. Another historical oversight where the true power of ether was tragically missed or misunderstood. It's like the medical community just couldn't quite see what was right in front of them.
These repeated lost moments for ether, they really highlight something important, don't they? That discovery alone often isn't enough for true medical progress, for a groundbreaking idea to really take hold.
Yeah.
There needs to be effective communication, yes, but also a collective recognition of the significance and, critically, the courage to actually challenge the status quo.
Yeah, that courage seems key.
The solutions were literally there, in plain sight, being used occasionally, but the understanding of their profound revolutionary impact was lagging considerably behind the actual experiments. It just shows how difficult it is for a deeply embedded paradigm like the inevitability of pain to truly shift, even when you're presented with compelling evidence against it.
So, looking back at these decades leading up to the mid-1840s, it is this fascinating and frankly deeply frustrating paradox. Multiple potential solutions to surgical pain, nitrous oxide, ether, chloroform, they were discovered, observed, sometimes even tested successfully. Yet for years, the medical community either dismissed them, overlooked them, or just didn't grasp the significance. Patients endured immense suffering. Surgeons relied on sheer speed and sometimes physical restraint rather than any kind of real pharmacological intervention.
It truly was a different world.
It really was, almost barbaric from our perspective, though not for lack of caring necessarily, but maybe for lack of understanding and that willingness to embrace radical new ideas.
So what does this all mean for us today, thinking about this history? Well, this deep dive really reminds us that innovation often begins with a keen observation, sometimes from the most unlikely places, right? A young chemist experimenting on himself, a dentist trying something new, a physician experimenting with animals.
Yeah, not always the established professors.
Exactly. But maybe more importantly, true progress in medicine requires not just discovery, but also recognition, clear, effective communication. And that courage we mentioned, the courage to challenge established beliefs, especially those that feel like undeniable truths at the time. The conquest of surgical pain wasn't a single dramatic eureka moment. It was a slow unfolding, like a city of ideas gradually building its highways until finally this unimaginable level of pain could actually be conquered.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Slow unfolding. And thinking about that slow unfolding, it really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other groundbreaking discoveries might be happening right now, maybe in unexpected corners, maybe looking like chimeras to some, that we, or perhaps the broader medical community, are currently overlooking? What future anesthesia moments are waiting out there for their proper recognition?
It's a provocative thought. History certainly suggests we should keep our eyes and minds open.
Definitely something to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to OptimalAnesthesia.com. And if you're looking for exclusive content, early releases, and deeper clinical insights, you'll find all that at patreon.com/OptimalAnesthesia by Rennie. Support the learning, support the craft. See you on the next one.